Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As we all hunker down in social isolation, in hope of staving off the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, how do we maintain our connections to community and social activism? Since KBOO has shut down all volunteer operations, we are producing our programming from our homes or other safe remote locations and finding ways to heighten our sense of community in the face of social fragmentation. Today we talk again with Southern Oregon activist and environmental writer Emma Maris about the steep challenges and potential opportunities this crisis presents to us. We need solidarity more than ever, and we hope this show will help. Emma, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Great to be here.
When we first planned this interview, we were going to talk about how people can feel less guilty and more proactive in fighting climate change by not worrying so much about how much you're driving and worry more about how much you're working with the community to stop really major carbon-intensive projects. Now that we're faced with this COVID-19 pandemic, how does that fold into your attitude about what's the best way to work together?
Well, I still feel that working together on systemic change, on big changes about how our economies, our governments are run, how we live our lives, is just much more effective than trying to work on your own personal carbon footprint. So I still feel like that's the focus we should keep in mind as our priority. And it does mean shifting tactics. It's a little harder to do that kind of collective action when we can't physically get together. But there are some ways to do it. And I still feel that continuing to work on climate change stuff during this time will help with anxiety about climate change. And it'll also maybe help us with our anxiety about this situation, because remaining productive and connected with our communities, even if virtually, is going to be a lot better for our mental health.
It's kind of a contradiction that I've been finding, maybe an ironic contradiction, that I feel like my carbon footprint is rising during this time because I'm driving more. I'm not driving with friends. In fact, I have plans to meet a friend this afternoon, and I think we're going to both have to drive to the place to meet each other because it's a little too scary to drive in the car with somebody that you're not living with. So again, how do we kind of counter, or how do we synthesize our concerns about climate change and our own personal footprint, carbon footprints, with ways to stay safe in this pandemic?
Well, I think really, like, you know, the number one focus that people need to keep in mind is their own personal safety and the safety of their loved ones. And so that means taking precautions, all the regular COVID precautions. And if that means, you know, maybe you're using some disposable wipes or something, I think you need to forgive yourself for that. And you know, not try to be a perfect green consumer at this time. I mean, ultimately, the way we're going to win on the climate, the way that we're going to kind of take control of our planet and form healthy relationships with the non-human world is by big sweeping changes in things like government policies around fossil fuels. It's not going to be about how many paper towels did you use this week. So we just need to keep our eyes on the big picture when it comes to climate change activism, and then keep our eyes on sort of the small picture when it comes to keeping safe in this time.
Well, speaking of the big picture, I think that the feds kind of showed their stuff yesterday when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had a meeting and they approved conditionally their permit to allow Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline to be built. And I think a lot of us were hoping that they might take a pause in this during the pandemic and let us think about other things, but that's not the way it is. So I'm wondering what your response was to that decision. And also, as somebody who's a lot closer to it than we are up here in Portland, what do you know about the decision and what's going to happen next?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was really disappointing, but not ultimately surprising, that even in the middle of this national global health emergency, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission decided it was important enough to vote yes on this fossil fuel project. And I think that that's a good wake-up call for all of us, right? We are going to need to use a lot of our brain power to cope with this coronavirus stuff. But the forces that want to keep drilling and pipelining fossil fuels around are not going to stop. They're not going to give up during this time. And so we need to continue to fight them virtually from our isolation.
Yeah, I was involved in my first virtual fight of it yesterday because I got invited into a Zoom meeting, which a bunch of people, mostly from Southern Oregon, and some of the landowners who are impacted by the pipeline were at. And it was a new experience for me, and it was interesting to watch the way we're all interacting through computer screens. And I actually found it both a combination of being a little unnerving and also thinking, if it weren't for this pandemic, I probably wouldn't have even been invited to join. So how does this kind of take us looking ahead into the ways we need to connect with each other, at least for the foreseeable future?
Before we get to that, I do want to add a little more about the pipeline approval and sort of what it all means. And then we can talk about the sort of the Zoom approach to activism. But what I want to really emphasize is that even though the FERC has approved this pipeline, it cannot go forward at the present time because it is lacking three essential permits from the state of Oregon. So the company is trying to get at least one of those permits overturned by the Secretary of Commerce. But happily, Governor Brown has put out a strong statement suggesting that she will fight that and that she will try to, keep Oregon's right to regulate its own self and what goes on within its own borders paramount. So just because the FERC approved this doesn't mean it's going to happen. It still is lacking a very clear path forward. It's still lacking three important permits, and it cannot get going without those permits. So that's really important to keep in mind. It doesn't mean we've lost at all.
That's good to hear. I'm wondering, did Kate Brown make any more statements since the one she made a few weeks ago when the Coastal Management Act permit was denied?
Yes, she made a statement in the last 24 hours, a pretty strong statement, sort of saying that she was surprised that the FERC had bothered to come together and vote on this matter during the current emergency, and also sort of making it clear that she would fight to protect the right of Oregon to regulate itself within its own borders and fight for these, permits. So that was really welcome and really good to see.
Now, do you think that the time you spent sitting in her office last November may have kind of helped to shape her more of an activist take that she's taking now?
That is a great question, and I wish I knew. Maybe someday when this is all over, we can all get together and she can tell us what her thinking was through this time. I mean, she's still in her statement. She still says that feels like she needs to be a neutral party and not come down on one side or the other, which is something that we've long been disappointed with. On the other hand, now that her state agencies have denied these permits, she is going to step up and defend those decisions. So that's really helpful.
Well, I think we should also just remind listeners that you were one of the 21 people who sat in at the governor's office in November. And what was the upshot of that, actually?
Well, there were way more than 21 people sitting in the office. At some points, I'm sure we had 200 people in there. It was warm. it was a really big group. In the end, there were 21 of us who were arrested that day for trespassing. But those charges were never filed against us. So they did not proceed with any kind of prosecution against us.
Which actually I thought was kind of a good sign of what the governor might be feeling in her heart.
Yeah, so I just found this statement. I just pulled it up. She says, given a national and state emergency, it is stunning that the FERC moved forward on this decision today. So clearly she thinks this is just absolutely the wrong priority, and that's great to hear. And then near the end of her statement, she says, I will not stand for any attempt to ignore Oregon's authority to protect public safety, health, and the environment. So that's good to hear. And we need to really support her when push comes to shove. And if these do end up in the courts, part of what we're going to need to do is let her know that we're glad she's fighting on behalf of Oregon's environment.
Now, one of the things that I learned from the Zoom meeting I was watching last night is that there's a lot of concern that even though FERC, Jordan Cove can't go ahead and either build the pipeline or the terminal yet, that this may give them the go-ahead to start imposing eminent domain and start basically taking landowners to court to take their property from them. And is that an actual concern, or is that more just kind of a vague possibility?
Yeah, that's a little bit above my pay grade with the legal ins and outs of the takings and the eminent domain. But one thing that I do know is that the landowners have come together and become this really amazing team. And that they're not going to take any kind of action against their land lying down. They are prepared to fight anything along those lines. So that's something, you know, that we should keep an eye on. If those fights start to happen, we can support them. What's interesting about those, all those landowners coming together, and you talked about joining the Zoom call, is that because this pipeline goes all the way from Klamath County to Coos Bay across so many different Oregon counties, we have had to organize remotely for a long time. And a lot of these meetings have been on Zoom. I've been on lots of Zoom meetings about the pipeline fight in for the last, you know, many months. So some of these remote tools are things that we've already been using. And I bet a lot of these landowners are now pretty Zoom fluent. You know, they can hop on one of these calls. They know how to do it. It's been a useful tool in this particular fight. And it is different than getting together, you know, with a cup of tea. But I do think that it's surprisingly effective.
Actually, one of the things that kind of touched me was I was watching all these people, and they're all at home. So I got to see where Frances Etherington lives. And actually, I kind of know her land pretty well, so it was kind of nice to see that again. And it's to see other people in the kind of comfort of their home, as well as kind of this mixed thing. They're in their comfort and also in this isolation. But I felt that there was this real personalness about seeing people in that light rather than meeting all in a kind of sterile meeting room. And maybe that's something else that the landowners have been fostering for the last few years, do you think?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, the thing about this kind of virtual coming together is, yeah, you see people's dogs and cats and their kids wandering through, and there is a kind of a homey feel to it screens are screens, but we can create connection using them if we do it right.
What are some of the things that you think are really different about doing meetings virtually that are more of a challenge than meeting in person?
Well, I mean, obviously there is just a kind of a magic to being in close personal contact. That's why everybody is really feeling this isolation the way that they are. But I think that there are also kind of upsides to the remote meeting. And, you know, as somebody who lives in a more remote part of the state, these Zoom meetings or virtual meetings of any kind, you know, there's different software that you can use. Getting together this way can actually be more welcoming for people who live far away or for people who have really small kids at home that they're taking care of or older parents that they can't leave. Or for people with disabilities, it makes it difficult for them to get to meeting places. Also, some people who are in different parts of the neurological spectrums who might actually just prefer interacting that way. So I'm hoping that we actually take this opportunity to expand our communities into some of those groups that might actually think, yes, now I can finally join. Now I can finally become part of this community because I don't have to show up in person in order to be part of it.
Well, it seems like there's a potential for there to be some upsides to this pandemic as well as we're learning new skills and maybe thinking in different ways. And actually, one of the things that I think connects in my mind what we're coming together now around the pandemic, it sort of reminds me of the way the landowners in Southern Oregon have come together to fight the pipeline and Jordan Cove LNG export terminal from a wide array of political from the wide range of the political spectrum. I wonder if you see that maybe this pandemic is sort of doing the same thing for the rest of us who aren't necessarily fighting the pipeline, but are now dealing with a real common threat and dealing with it in a way that it's only going to be dealt with if we do it in a funny way. Even though we're isolated, we need to do it in community.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a tricky thing to talk about because we don't want to say, yay, the pandemic is great because it's giving us all these opportunities because people are dying. This is obviously a tragedy, a global tragedy. But as we try to cope with and grapple with how to, you know, slow down these infections and how to stop the sort of, you know, suffering of people who are losing their jobs and so on, one thing that I'm noticing already is that a lot of policies or changes that people sort of said were impossible are suddenly happening. Things that, you know, like proposals to give people monthly income with no strings attached, reduction or kind of pauses on eviction, debt cancellation, internet access for low-income people. I see a lot of cities are trying to get their houseless population into housing really quickly. some prisoners are getting released, some transit is getting free. I mean, these are a lot of priorities that people had on their wish list and that were sort of people were saying, oh, that's unrealistic. But when we're all together in this crisis, some of these things suddenly become politically possible. And I think the real lesson from this is that, well, there's a couple of lessons. One is that we have to work together as a collective in order to move forward. We cannot keep trying to go on as a nation of rugged individuals all living cheek by jowl with each other. If we're going to live together, we have to be a collective. And then the other lesson is just that we can actually change policies fast, and we can change them in a pretty big way. So taking that lesson forward and applying it to things like climate change, you know, maybe the climate change is ultimately as a threat to life, just as coronavirus is a threat to life. And if we can make these kinds of sweeping changes, then we can hopefully make them in order to cope with the climate crisis. I mean, as people are suffering unemployment, something like a Green New Deal seems like the perfect time for that. So it's, everything is moving extremely quickly, and there's a lot up in the air, but I'm really hopeful that there can be some sort of really good things that grow out of this coming together and this fight against this virus. I know there's a lot of tragedy and there's a lot of suffering, but I hope that in the end there can also be some good as well.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Southern Oregon activist and environmental writer Emma Maris about the steep challenges and potential opportunities presented to us by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, I find it interesting that a lot of the Democrats are like really holding, we could call it the thin green line, against some of the Republican proposals for bailing out the airline industry and the fossil fuel industry. And one of the things that I found interesting, I'm not sure where this is going yet, but I guess they're no longer talking about bailing out the airlines and the fossil fuel industry. They're talking about giving them loans, I guess no interest loans, as well as giving them to everybody else in the country, maybe, or other small businesses. But the stipulations that a number of Democrats are going to put on the table as far as any kind of help for the airline industry is that, first of all, the money has to go to paying the airline workers. It can't go to CEOs. It can't go to bonuses. It can't go to stock buybacks. And then the other thing that I found very interesting is that there's a number of Democrats in Congress who are insisting that if the airlines are to get any money from the federal government, they also need to drastically cut back their carbon footprint and show how they're going to do it. I'm wondering what you thought about that is.
I mean, these are all good signs. Again, it's early days. We are really in the beginning of this. And so it could kind of go either way, I feel like. There's going to be good policy changes that come out of this. There's going to be bad policy changes that come out of this. I think that, you know, we're all feeling a little bit, at least a little bit, if not a lot, unnerved by all this. Our routines have changed. We're afraid. But getting engaged with these kinds of things, calling up our representatives, saying that we support those kinds of conditions on these loans, I think that can actually, you know, getting involved with this kind of stuff can really help with those feelings of stress and fear. So I'm hoping that people do, you know, pick up the phone or get involved with an organization virtually to try to make the big changes that are going to come out of this good ones.
I'm wondering what your sense, I mean, we just know the little that we know, but I have been feeling very, it gives me a lot of encouragement getting these emails I'm getting from Earl Blumenauer, from Ron Wyden, of course, from Jeff Merkley, who I expect the best from anyway, but talking about issues in ways that frame them exactly the way I feel about them, and in particular around all the concerns about providing support, meaningful support for all the workers that are losing their jobs, for small businesses that are going to go under if there's not some kind of help, and that looking at really creative ways of doing it. Do you feel like there's maybe a change in kind of the more mainstream Democrats that they're starting to understand, as well as some Republicans even, that we have to do things really differently if we're going to survive this?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'll caveat that by saying that I am an optimist to my bones. So So, you know, whenever I see those kinds of, you know, I'm always hoping for good changes and good futures. And so, yes, when I see these kinds of policies being talked about as realistic by sort of what I consider to be more mainstream Democrats, I get really excited. I hope my optimism and excitement are borne out. I hope that when we look back 6 months from now or a year from now, we see this as a turning point where our ability to care for each other just sort of turned a corner into real policies that actually do that, that actually take care of each other, not just from, you know, take care of each other in a healthcare way, but just more broadly. I hope that's true. We'll have to see. Things are moving. Things are all up in the air.
Well, actually, let's get a little bit more back to healthcare, because that's one thing that you didn't mention in the list of very progressive policies that are being discussed and some of them actually being enacted. The whole idea of sick leave and paid family health care. Let's talk a bit about why that's been such a difficult right for the American public and certainly the American government to appreciate, and how that might be shifting now.
I think it definitely is shifting. I think it's been a long process of making that concept more mainstream here in this country. But I think we're very, you know, we're very close, and I think this healthcare situation may tip us over. But I'm not an expert in healthcare policy. I'm just, a person who gets sick like everybody else. But I really do hope that we come out of this with something that actually takes care of our people.
Now, would you have ever thought before, well, actually, when we were all watching the virus first spreading in China and then spreading in Southern Europe, could you have imagined that we probably can imagine that we were going to get it, but that it would have such a shift in the conversations that we're having now?
No, things are happening really fast. I mean, I was supposed to give a couple of lectures in Portland on like the 16th, 17th, and 18th of March. And until about a week before those lectures, I was still in conversations with organizers about should we cancel, you know, and now that seems like 10 years ago. Things are moving extremely quickly. And I have two little kids, so I'm spending a lot of my mental energy, and I have parents who are elderly and who live in Seattle. So I have, you know, I think all of us are spending a lot of our mental energy just coping with our close circle of friends and family and neighbors, and coping with just processing all these changes. But as that Jordan Cove approval from FERC that came on Thursday shows, you know, we can't spend months processing because the fight goes on.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. When we were talking on the phone the other day, you were talking about all the things we have to be looking out for. So what are some of your concerns about things that kind of might slip under the barriers while we're busy trying to protect ourselves from getting sick and our community from getting sick and our neighborhood businesses from going out of business?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Trump administration, who has been uniformly trying to put through destructive environmental policies since the moment they got into power, is absolutely 100% not going to stop doing that during the current crisis. We're just going to have to remain hooked into our networks, giving us information about what's going on and how we can help. And, if we're at home, some of us are still working. We're at hospitals and grocery stores and restaurants setting up takeout orders. And some of us, though, are stuck at home, and we might find ourselves endlessly reading coronavirus news. And it's good for us, I think, to take a little breather from that and to sort of say, okay, well, what's going on with the climate now? What's going on with these changes in policy? How can I help? More and more going forward, because this coronavirus part of our lives is not going to be over anytime soon. It's going to be months, not weeks. So we're going to need to learn patterns of living, rhythms of living that are not 100% dominated by the virus.
One of the things that you mentioned when we talked before is ways that we need to reach out to people in our community. And it's a different, I mean, I've been getting a lot of emails about, you know, things that we need to be aware of and things that we need to change. What are some of the things that you have taken on yourself and that you recommend for other people to do that would really make an impact on the way that we together get through this crisis?
Right. So, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that some of our activist networks are a lot more intergenerational than some of our other social networks, which is one of their amazing strengths. So if you're in a kind of a group with older people or immunocompromised people, people with underlying conditions, great to reach out, see if they need groceries, see if they need you to pick up their prescription, so on. I think taking care of our networks, our community, is priority number one. So that means our families, our friends, our groups, our activist groups, and our neighborhoods. I'm the precinct committee person for my neighborhood for the Democratic Party. And so I just started calling all the older Democrats in my on my list and checking in with them, seeing how they're doing. And so far, they all seem to be doing well, but many of them wanted to talk with me about plans they had to cancel or how they're feeling. And just having those conversations with people is actually a great help, just listening to people and how they're feeling and letting them talk. You know, people are stuck isolated from each other, and they need that connection.
I'm curious what you feel when you go to the grocery store. Are you noticing a big change in terms of the way people are relating to each other?
Yeah, there's certainly a hesitancy. I mean, here in Klamath Falls, we don't have completely bare shelves or anything at this, you know, which doesn't mean you should drive to Klamath Falls to go grocery shopping, please. Thank you.
It's a long drive.
At some level, it's still heartbreaking to see your neighbors walking down the street and to go and stand on your porch and talk to them from 10 feet away instead of giving them a hug. That's tough. It makes me wonder how much of these changes are going to really kind of flavor our lives for not just months to come, but years to come. I think that we're all going to, you know, someday we're going to be able to hug each other on the street again. And I hope that, you know, that day comes sooner rather than later.
Well, one of the things that I've been noticing both with friends and with neighbors that I'm close with, and then with people that I just see in the grocery store, is that with a lot of us, there's this shared understanding of why we're standing 6 or 10 feet away from each other. And there's this new smile, I guess I could call it the coronavirus smile, that we give because we understand it. And there's getting across the brink and looking at each other like, you know, I'm doing this because I care about you, as opposed to like, right, I come up and, you know, and give you a hug because I care about you. I wonder how we start to, you know, find a kind of make it maybe a new body language to share with people, because we are acknowledging that we're all going through the same thing together.
I think that smile is definitely part of it. I think, you know, verbal expressions of care that, you know, maybe we're used to expressing how we feel with a hug or a hearty handshake, and maybe we can come up with words to create that same feeling of like, oh, it's so wonderful to see you. It makes me feel good to see you. You know, just saying something like that. I mean, one thing that I think is interesting about all this is that our society is making major rapid changes because we care for each other, and we care for the elderly among us, and we care for those of us who are ill and have underlying conditions. And it's kind of amazing, actually, because in our normal day-to-day capitalist, you know, just day-to-day, it doesn't really seem like we care for each other. It seems like our society is organized in order for everybody just to get their own and scramble on top of each other. And so the fact that we are actually willing to do these massive changes in order to care for each other exposes that underneath all that capitalistic crap, there really is a core of care. And that gives me so much hope for the future. If we can activate that and make that the kind of the center of all of our policies and the center of our decision making, we could do so much. We could be so much. So, you know, this is an incredibly difficult time, but it's exposing the fact that we still have a heart.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Southern Oregon activist and environmental writer Emma Maris about the steep challenges and potential opportunities presented to us by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Some of the most emotional times I have are actually when I go to the grocery store, and we have a wonderful neighborhood market not too far from our house, and I've been going there probably way too often, I mean, almost once a day, and I'm read today, you're not supposed to do that. But I, first of all, trust the store. I mean, they're doing a really good job of keeping the place clean. And the customers, for the most part, are doing a very good job of social distancing and being respectful. And except for the toilet paper shelf, which they can't do much about, they're staying pretty well stocked. Though there was a run on chicken a few days ago. Did you have that down in Klamath Falls, where there was no chicken available?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
one of the people in the meat, behind the meat counter said, yes, chicken, the food of the apocalypse. but the chicken's back on the shelf. So yesterday, the hummus was gone. So it's really interesting to see what the runs are, that where people are going. But one of the things that I get is a sense of camaraderie with people. And then also the other day, I heard a woman saying to one of the checkout clerks, I really appreciate this store. I really appreciate what you're doing for the community. And this is something people didn't used to say to their clerks. And I think that people are feeling, even in the grocery stores, I mean, I can't even imagine. I haven't been to a hospital recently. I hope I don't have to go. But I can imagine what people are feeling to the frontline workers, healthcare workers in the hospitals who are working unprotected and really at risk. But this to me is like, it's kind of bringing out this part of us that usually just kind of stays trapped inside.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that. One thing that I think that this crisis is exposing is who are really the valuable workers in our society. You know, the people who stock the shelves at the grocery store, home health care aides, physician's assistants, the techs at the hospitals and doctor's office, the nurses, and the people who are, you know, who give you your blood pressure and your weight when you first walk in. Some of these professions are not well paid. Some of these professions are not considered to be glamorous. But now we're seeing that these are the people who are really holding our society together. It is not the people who work in marketing at a company, you know, a shoe company or something. It is the people who take care of us, who help us get fed. Those are the people who are stitching everything together. And I'm hoping that once we've realized that, we will be able to reward them better and to make sure that they are taken care of and to make sure that they are esteemed and that they can go to the doctor when they need to without worrying about the cost. There is a possibility here for there to be a real shift for us to really see where the value is in our society. And I hope we take advantage of that.
Well, one of the things that's really concerning me amongst many is all the people that are losing their jobs. I mean, some of these are friends of ours. I have a friend who works at Powell's Books who they closed last week and they laid off most of their staff. And we've been talking to her about what she's going to do. And hopefully they're going to get unemployment insurance. But I got an email from Powell's the other day talking about how people expected them to keep the staff on salary even though they closed the store and be able to pay their health care. Emily Powell, the owner, saying, we don't really have the budget to do that. We're working on, she described it as kind of a duct tape operation, which I'm not sure that I see Powell's as being that impoverished a store, but certainly they're not like Amazon or anything like that. But the thing that was really impressed me, then I got an email from our credit union, and they talked about how they're going to be shutting down. Some of their workers are going to work remotely. Some of them are not going to be able to come in at all. They're keeping the banks open, but they're paying everybody their full salary and their health care. And I thought, well, I guess our credit union is in better financial shape than Powell's Books is. But to me, that's a real model of what so many businesses should be doing. And I don't know how many businesses really are doing that.
Yeah, I mean, when I spoke about the different workers that are stitching us all together, I should have also mentioned delivery workers and mail carriers who are going to increasingly be connecting us with the stuff that we need to keep going as well. I mean, there's so, this is just really, and I would personally put Powell's bookstore employees into a pretty high category of necessary workers stitching society together, because I think that being able to go into a bookstore and browse is a human pleasure that we should work hard as a society to protect. Even if we need to have government bailouts of Powell's Book, I'm all for that.
Well, I hope it looks like the government is going to be bailing out small businesses. So I'm really hoping that Powell's, amongst a lot of other small businesses, both locally and nationally, are going to get some help. And I don't see it coming, but I know that in some of the Democratic proposals, there is mention of funding that would provide salaries for everybody who is not going to be able to come in and work for the next who knows how long. So that's something I think we should keep the pressure on. And I mean, right now it seems like the main way we can do our activism is through online petitions. I think I signed 5 or 6 of them this morning, but that, I mean, I'm not sure how effective those are, but I think just even staying, you know, reading the things that come through and staying in touch with what the concerns are and then finding ways to reach out, to me, is really important.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of new and exciting tactics that people dream up. I saw a quote from an organizer at the Stop the Money Pipeline group recently. That's a offshoot of 350 that's really working on targeting financial institutions that invest in and make money off of fossil fuels. And he talks about things like people moving their money out of banks that are investing in fossil fuels and cutting up credit cards and tweeting at CEOs and calling up corporate headquarters. You know, there's a lot of stuff we can do from our homes besides just the petitions are great, but there's also more sort of coordinated action that we can do without ever leaving the house. So we're going to be seeing more and more of that and more sort of innovation in that space, I think.
Well, another thing that I'm finding interesting is our relationship to our elders, and I'm actually part of that cohort of people now, and it's been very interesting. My partner talks a lot about how she feels like we're in this kind of victim category because we are at the most risk for this virus. What's interesting to me is to see the ways that certain sectors of our communities are reaching out to older people. And I mean, this grocery store that I go to, I mean, they were the first story. Now many others are instituting it where they have a senior hour from 8 to 9 for seniors and for people who have pre-existing conditions. So they can shop without being afraid of being, well, first of all, there'll be fewer people in the store, but also that the theory is anyway that a lot of the carriers are people that are younger, so this would protect
right.
them. But the other thing has been really cool. I mean, we got a note in our mailbox a couple of days ago from some neighbors who live across the street. They're nice people. We're sort of friendly with them, but we don't know them that well, not nearly as well as some of our other neighbors. And basically in the note, they said, let us know if you need anything. If you're feeling like you don't want to leave the house, let us know. We can go shopping for you, run errands. And later on, we were out walking, and we waved to our neighbor across the street and thanked him for the note. And he said, yeah, I guess you guys would go for more walks than we do. But it was it was real touching. And I think that I sort of get the feeling that that's happening more, that people are reaching out to their elderly neighbors and to, as you were describing, to people in groups you work with. But I think just kind of in general that there's more of a sense of really protecting our elders. And maybe that's another thing that's been really lacking in this society is respect for one's elders. So do you think that that might be switching as well?
Yeah, I think one interesting dynamic that goes on with that, though, is that there are some people who are being reached out to as elders who are maybe not quite used to conceiving of themselves as elders, and so there could be a little bit of that can be kind of difficult if somebody sees themselves as middle aged and then they get a note on their door from their you know, Generation Z neighbor saying, are you okay, you old person? And so one thing I really do encourage people to do is to just like really take that love, even if they think I'm not old enough to be in this category. I follow somebody on Twitter who describes himself as a young elder. So, you know, if that's a category that feels right for you to claim, maybe that's a category that you can claim right now as a young elder.
Well, I mean, for me, it's been a little bit of a disconnect because I do think of myself as being pretty healthy and being very active. But I also, but I appreciated that people are looking out for us. And I think for me, it's also kind of a necessarily humbling experience to accept that, yes, I am maybe as old as I am. And I have to, you know, think about it realistically in those terms and that I do have to maybe take a little better care than I thought I did a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right. I have a lot of friends. I'm in my 40s. I have a lot of friends who are, I think people are settling down now into this and taking it pretty seriously. But in the previous weeks, a lot of people my age were struggling with their parents who weren't ready to kind of stay home and play solitaire and look at birds. They wanted to, you know, they didn't see themselves in that category. So I think it's like, you know, there's so much about this that is challenging and difficult and sad. And I'm just hoping that some of these things that we've talked about today, some of the reaching out to our neighbors and to our community, some of the recognizing where the true value in our society is, and some of these progressive policies that suddenly seem achievable, I'm just hoping some of this can be a silver lining to what's a really hard situation for everybody around the world.
Well, I want to talk about one of the hardest things, at least for me, is thinking in terms of not knowing what, you know, the future is going to be and how long this is going to go on. And I wanted to bring up this article that you wrote for National Geographic that's coming out on Wednesday this week that talks about 2070. And I want to just discuss the difference between your being able to visualize what the world might be like in 2070 and what it might be like in August 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of us now, looking forward 4 or 5 months, is kind of almost scary. We have no idea how long this is going to last, or how long will we be stuck inside, and what's going on. And that's very anxiety producing, and it's totally uncertain. But if you give yourself a moment to kind of breathe and think about a longer term future, I was asked by National Geographic months ago to start thinking about what would a good 2070 look like. And the occasion is actually the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which is this coming up next month. So it's been 50 years since the first Earth Day. So they wanted me to kind of look forward another 50 years and imagine what it would be like then. And I wrote a very optimistic, you know, kind of really leaning on those optimistic bones of mine, take on if we really pull together and do everything right, you know, what could a good future look like in 50 years? So I encourage you guys to check it out if you are feeling uncertain and nervous about the immediate future, because I think giving ourselves a little temporal break and realizing that, you know, 50 years from now, this will be a part of our past and something that we move through, and that we can have all sorts of different futures in 50 years from now is a possibility. I think we're so caught up in thinking about the day-to-day and the week-to-week and the month-to-month. It can be really cleansing and grounding to realize that we also need to be planning for and thinking about 50 years from now, 100 years from now.
Some of the things in your article that you describe, which I found very comforting and a little bit surprisingly optimistic, are not that different from some of the things that you're talking about that may possibly come out of the changes that might come out of this pandemic. So I want to talk about a little bit about the way the world looked, your vision of the ways that we might learn from the crises we're going through now in 50 years to have a world that looks more like the Green New Deal, let's say.
Right. Yeah. So in the piece, I imagine that we sort of get our act together on taking climate change seriously as a global community, and that we put in place really strong and fast policies to phase out fossil fuels immediately and to ramp up renewables and to reduce our global atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gas, including some removing of that either through tree planting or even through some of these more high-tech means that people are just starting to work on. So I'm imagining a 2070 where, you know, there is already more warming baked into the system that we cannot avoid at this point, even if we tomorrow turned off every fossil fuel pipe in the world. So my 2070 is a little hotter than today. I don't think we can get away from that. But it's also one that has embraced the true values of society, where people are healthy and they are happy and they are lifted out of poverty, and where we also coexist with the non-human world in a way where we don't separate ourselves from it. We don't say the only way to save nature is to ban ourselves from it. Instead, we have productive and positive relationships with other species that are, and nature is more interwoven into our lives. I also talk a little bit in the piece about the importance of tribal sovereignty and making sure that our approaches to tackle climate change are not going to get sort of re-instantiate colonial patterns. So I talk about having big climate change research centers in tropical countries all around the world that are seeing the biggest impacts of climate change. And I talk about taking tribal sovereignty really seriously, which is an important step, I think, towards addressing just some of the historical injustices that have set us down this path, this destructive path. So it is. It's an optimistic vision. It's a vision where I sort of assume that we get our act together and that we make good on some of the mistakes of the past, and then we try to rectify them. And I found it really healing to write. So I'm hoping that readers also find it somewhat healing to read. Because as we fight for a good future, I just think it's really important that instead of just fighting against destruction and fighting against apocalypse, I think it's just really important that we have a vision in our heads of what we're fighting for.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Southern Oregon activist and environmental writer Emma Maris about the steep challenges and potential opportunities presented to us by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, how does that relate, do you think, to what we're dealing with now? I mean, how do we maybe carry some of the visions of things like universal health care and actually a minimum, guaranteed minimum income for everybody and housing for everybody and all these issues that are really coming to the surface with this pandemic? Do you see a connection between what we're doing now and what your vision is for 2070?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that they both spring from this notion of care, that we have as human beings, we have a potential to care for each other and to care for the non-human world and to actually make that a higher priority value than wealth and profit, which is what we've been running society on for the last 250 years or more. And you know, our willingness in local to national governments to take an economic hit in order to stop people from dying, it's ultimately hopeful, you know, that we're willing to do that. And I think that we can build off that. We can try to say, no, we actually care more about each other and about other species than we care about profit, and make that our core value. Is it possible that we can do that on a broader scale and that this crisis can help us see that that's a more important value? I'm hopeful. Again, I'm optimistic to my bones. So
you're more optimistic than I am. And I've always felt that was my role. I had to be the optimist amongst everybody who's a doomsayer. So it's really good to talk to you. Well, in the last part, many moments that we have, I'd like to go back to Jordan Cove and talk about what can be done, some really proactive things that people can do, and how you see the next few months unfolding. And I guess my sense is that this pandemic's going to be long gone, hopefully. We'll still be fighting Jordan Cove. Do you think that that's probably true?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't speculate. I mean, they're both tough roads ahead. Let's just leave it at that.
So what do you think specifically that people can be doing to help out?
Sure. So I think the first thing is people who are eager to help out with the pipeline fight. And I'm hoping that people are all across the state. It is a Southern Oregon project, but the fracked gas that it would burn would go into our shared environment. So this is everybody's problem. And there are certain groups they can hook up with and make sure they're on their newsletter list. Groups like Rogue Climate, Positions for Social Responsibility, which is a great group to hook up with in the current situation, obviously, and Power Pact Fracked Gas Coalition. All those groups are great, and you can follow them on Facebook or on Twitter or get their email alerts, and they'll keep you updated on when is the time to send in comments, when is the time to call the governor, or to maybe do some kind of cool online virtual protest. So that'll be the sort of central clearinghouse for action. And I think that there's people there who are keeping a very close eye on the sort of policy stuff going forward, and will let us all know about what happens with this the company going to the Wilbur Ross at the Commerce Department and trying to get those permits overturned, or at least the coastal zone permit overturned. They'll let us know as that goes forward when we can help and how we can help. So that would be the main thing to do today.
And I'll be putting links on the Locus Focus website for all these different groups, and people can connect that way too. I guess that we're really looking forward to a lot more connection through the internet. And so I wonder what can be done. How can we strengthen the internet to make it much more of an equitable tool for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, I'm becoming more and more convinced that the internet needs to be a free public good. I'm seeing here in my county some offers for 60-day free internet so that children who are staying home from school can do virtual school. That's the kind of thing that we need to just have all the time. At this point in 2020, everybody needs to have access to a reliable internet. It's just a utility now and one that should be a right.
Actually, Portland school system, which is shut down through at least till the end of April, And they're not doing any online education because it has to do with equity. There are a significant number of students in the school system who do not have internet access. And there's also been some talk, I think that, it might have been Comcast actually, is offering, I think basically free internet access for people in need. And I kind of checked it out and it's really minimal. It's a very minimal speed. So it might be fast enough for online education. But the other part of it is, I mean, I think when you do serious broadband, it needs to be a certain speed to be able to do the things that we are, like doing Zoom meetings and stuff that takes a little bit more bandwidth. So do you see ways to agitate to get the universal broadband as one of the goals for our communities?
Yeah, I don't know as much about that as I probably should, but I think that's something that going forward is going to be important, because if people can't connect over the internet, it's going to be hard for them to especially in rural communities, to help be part of this movement.
Let's talk a little bit about the election. I mean, neither one of us are experts about the election, but we vote. And I mean, this is something that's really being thrown now. All the campaigning is being done virtually. I saw images the other day of Bernie Sanders at the Tacoma Dome recently. You know, there were like 25,000 people. It was a really amazing event. And we were looking forward to him coming to Portland in May for our primary, but obviously he won't be. He probably won't even be running at that point. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about how to make the elections more equitable. I mean, the obvious thing is universal vote by mail, but I wonder if you have other thoughts about how we go into this election season, which would determine so much of our future, being stymied by not having most of the traditional ways that candidates campaign, or that we get together in order to support the candidates and the initiatives that we care about.
Yeah, I have, one thing to keep in mind is to not put all your energy and your eggs in the presidential race. That's obviously gets a lion's share of media attention, but there are so many local races around all of us that we can have much more impact on than the presidential race. And those can be super important: county commissioners, city council, school board, mayor, state representative. Those kinds of races are ones that I would really encourage your listeners to sort of check out and see which one they can find a candidate that speaks to them. Then how do you campaign for them when you can't go door knocking? And I think that there's text banking, which is a lot of fun, because you end up having these fun text-based conversations with voters. You can do phone calls. You can people are still putting out signs in their front lawns. And we're going to come up with new stuff, too. I mean, I think that this is just the beginning of going to be a real wave of creativity around kind of non-face-to-face campaign stuff. So I'm actually really looking forward to seeing what some of the younger people, not just the younger people, the older people too, but just coming up with creative, tech-savvy people come up with. It's going to be a kind of a blossoming of that kind of creativity.
Now, in terms of the length of time, let's just talk a bit more about that, because that's one of the things that really has people, I think, panicked. I was surprised when places were just closing for 3 weeks or till even like mid-April. And now we're starting to hear people talking about it being a little bit longer. And even the guy who's in the White House right now talked about this pandemic going on through August, this thing that he denied for so long we've even existed. So I just wonder, what is your sense of timing and how do we cope with not knowing what the timing might be?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not an epidemiologist, but the health reporters that I trust that have been on this beat for a long time are definitely making noises about this being months of big changes to our daily routines at any rate. So I know that that is very anxiety provoking for everybody. And I think that honestly, this is one of those times where we're going to have to get a little bit zen, and we're going to have to just be very present in our present week and think, what am I going to do with the kids tomorrow? What am I going to do in the garden this weekend? Who am I going to text bank for this season? And just think about, on shorter timescales, really take in the sunlight and the goldfinches at the feeder and figure out what you can do to stay engaged and support your community and help out your friends and your elders. Just focus on the more short term and the very long term. So think about this week, and think about 2070. And don't think so much about August for right now. Give it a couple weeks until we have a better sense of what it's going to look like.
Yeah, well, actually, I think I highly recommend going out for walks, especially while the sun is shining like it is today. That, I mean, I've been going to Oaks Bottom every day and seeing eagles and hawks and hummingbirds, and there's something very renewing about seeing the wildlife, not worrying about a pandemic.
Absolutely. If it's safe for you to get outside and take a walk, especially in a place that's a little more unhuman, that has a little more species in it, I would definitely recommend doing that every day if you can. It's extremely important for our mental health to look at things that are far away and to look at other species and to be around plants.
Well, Emma, it's really good to talk to you. I really appreciate your optimism. So stay healthy down there in Klamath Falls and we'll stay in touch.
Yes, likewise. Wonderful to talk with you.
Thanks a lot. Today, we've been talking with Southern Oregon activist and environmental writer Emma Maris, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk more about COVID-19 with epidemiologist Deborah Davis. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go up with some music by Steve Lacy. Stay safe and wash your hands. Thanks for listening. Thank you.